The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 9/May 16, 2022. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a smaller, narrower, white inner border. Time, the name, is in bright red, large block letters, upon a black background. Superimposed upon that black background is a portrait. It is in profile. It is in shades of grays and black. It is a portrait of Ukrainian President Zelensky, photographed April 19 in Kiev, inside the compound with the president and his team, how Zelensky leads. Again, this is in profile of a young to lower middle-aged looking man. He has dark hair, probably black or very dark brown, combed slightly forward on the top of his head. His nose is in profile. He's looking straight ahead, but it's not at the lens. It's at a 90-degree angle. He has facial hair trimmed closely to his face, not smiling, not frowning, but a very serious look on his countenance. Beginning then with For the Record, these are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 short items on one page. We will get a major recession, spoken by Deutsche Bank economists in a report to clients April 26. I know many who voted for me did not do so because they support me, but because they wanted to block the far right. Spoken by Emmanuel Macron, President of France, in a speech after winning re-election over Marine Le Pen, April 24. Three is the number of critically endangered Sumatran tigers found dead in traps in Indonesia, authorities said, April 25. I've been doing this for 40 years, and that was a first, said Tim Manley, fire department chief in Brennan, Washington, speaking to the Kitsap Sun, April 21. After rescuing a woman who'd fallen into the hole of a public outhouse while trying to retrieve her phone. 119, the age of Kana Tanaka of Japan at the time of her death, April 19. Tanaka was confirmed as the oldest living person in 2019, according to Guinness World Records. Starting from 13 years old, I would think about what I would do if my dad was killed, said Daria Navalnaya in a CNN documentary about her father, Alexei Navalny. $2.1 trillion global military spending in 2021. A record, according to an April 25 report from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, including $801 billion by the U.S. and $65.9 billion by Russia. We believe that they can win if they have the right equipment, the right support, said Lloyd Austin, U.S. Secretary of Defense, to reporters in Poland on his thoughts about the Ukraine and the war, April 25. Moving now to a photograph. It's about not quite a quarter of a page. It's in color, and it shows a lot of people lying down on a brick surface, perhaps a road, perhaps a patio. Oh, a lot of these people look young. Some of their faces are not visible, but the ones that are look young, like teenagers, young adults, wearing T-shirts and shorts and jeans and some other splashier-looking slacks. They have some signs, people, not profit, GCM for climate. People, not profit, again, and some more that are upside down. Oh, here's one, SOS, and the O looks like the world on a globe. Climate action, young climate activists stage a die-in in Lafayette Park across the White House on Earth Day, April 22. The Washington, D.C. protest was meant to highlight the lack of urgency in tackling climate change. Even as experts warn, the time in which its effects can still be mitigated is quickly dwindling. And was one of dozens of actions in cities around the globe that called on leaders to take stronger action and to bring an end to the use of fossil fuels. This is called the Bulletin Gaming Fame, that's G-A-M-ing Fame, in Philippines elections. And this is written by Chad de Guzman. More than 130,000 people gathered in downtown Pasig, P-A-S-I-G, a city just outside the Philippine capital of Manila, singing Ariana Grande's Break Free in March as part of a political rally organized by presidential candidate and current Vice President Lenny Robredo ahead of the May 9 presidential election. While the rally caught the attention of Grande, who shared a clip on her Instagram, it did little for Robredo's election hopes, with polls showing her trailing front-runner Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. Philippine elections have been heavy on the entertainment factor since the ouster of dictator Ferdinand Marcos, Bongbong's father, in 1986. But the crossover between showbiz and politics has reached a new level. Currently, five sitting senators out of 24 enjoy some sort of fame outside politics, including one-time world boxing champion Manny Pacquiao, who's also running for president. At least 36 celebrities are seeking public office in the Southeast Asian nation of 110 million. Just as fans of teleseries, Philippine dramas influenced by Mexican telenovelas, talk about bombshell revelations over dinner, families and neighbors discuss televised Senate hearings. Action stars hold particular sway. Outgoing President Rodrigo Duterte leaned into his nickname, Duterte Harry, a reference to the brutal 1970s detective played by Clint Eastwood. Bongbong Marcos is capitalizing on star power in a different way. His campaign has been light on policy, and he has skipped televised debates. Instead, he's leaning on his famous family's name, portraying his father's authoritarian regime as stable, despite human rights abuses. Ultimately, it is about breaking through the noise of the Philippines' many social ills, including poverty and corruption, says Ana Pertiera, an anthropologist at the University of Technology, Sydney. Many voters may not really feel like a traditional politician is going to solve the problems they feel they are experiencing. From the news ticker, three short articles. Israel shuts border with Gaza. Israel closed its border with the Gaza Strip April 24, preventing thousands of the territory's residents from going to work after several rocket attacks on Israel by Palestinian militants. Frequent violent escalations by Israeli police at the site of Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque have raised fears of a new upsurge in conflict. North Korea parades weapons at a military parade in Pyongyang, April 25. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un vowed to strengthen and develop his country's nuclear arsenal as fast as possible. The weapons displayed included a Hwasong-17 missile, theoretically capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. Kim said the arsenal's first mission was to deter war. New Ebola outbreak in the DRC. The Democratic Republic of Congo declared an Ebola outbreak April 23. A 31-year-old man died in northwestern Equator province, April 21, after first displaying symptoms April 5. His sister-in-law, 25, died April 25. Good question. Is it time to track at-home COVID-19 tests? This is by Jamie Ducharme. Official COVID-19 case counts are increasingly misleading. Many Americans now rely on at-home tests, the results of which are rarely shared with public health officials, so experts worry case numbers are now an unreliable way to judge the state of the pandemic. Unlike COVID-19 testing sites, which must share data with public health departments, individuals are not required to report the results of their home tests. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends people share their positive results with their doctor, who may recommend a laboratory test to confirm the result and add it to official tallies. But about 30% of people who tested positive using an at-home kit did not get a secondary test, according to a January survey from the COVID States Project. That number is likely higher now, given the closure of some mass testing sites, the end of free testing programs for the uninsured, and the relaxation of pandemic precautions. A national reporting system for home test data could help experts track the pandemic, but the question is how to make one work. Some state health departments and at-home test kits already have systems for voluntarily reporting results, but few people do. In a federal pilot program, more than 1.4 million tests were given to households in Tennessee and Michigan in 2021, but fewer than 10,000 test results were logged in a companion app, Health Affairs reports. Public health officials should work with test companies to make their self-reporting systems easier, says John Brownstein, Chief Innovation Officer at Boston Children's Hospital. Instead of downloading an app, for example, people could send in their results via text message. His research group also runs a website where people can quickly log their results and see disease trends in their area. Although 100% participation in such a system is unlikely without reporting requirements or incentives, Brownstein still thinks it has value. Not many people write Amazon reviews, he says, but enough do to give you a sense of the value of a product. Another possible option? Repeated surveys of American households, asking if anyone recently tested positive and on which type of test, says David Laser, co-author of the COVID States Project survey. Without such data, Laser says, the missingness in COVID-19 case counts is likely worse than ever. More brief news, another trio of short articles from the news ticker. Kamala Harris tests positive for COVID-19. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris tested positive for COVID-19, the White House said April 26. She had just returned from a week-long trip to California. According to the White House, she did not display symptoms and is isolating at home. Officials said she has not seen President Biden since April 18. Harvard addresses ties to slavery. An April 26 report on the practice of slavery at Harvard University found that the school's leaders, faculty, and staff enslaved more than 70 people during the 17th and 18th centuries. When slavery was legal in Massachusetts, the university said it will establish a $100 million fund to address the impacts. Judge holds Trump in contempt. A New York State judge held former President Donald Trump in contempt April 25 for failing to provide documents in a civil fraud investigation into his family's business dealings. Judge Arthur Engoron also ordered Trump to pay a fine of $10,000 each day until he complies. Trump's lawyers said they plan to appeal. From Milestones, died Wynn, W-Y-N-N, Bruce, 50, April 23, after setting himself on fire in front of the Supreme Court on Earth Day in an apparent protest over climate change. Recorded the hottest summer ever, 2021, with temperatures 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, the EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service said April 22. Convicted Major General William T. Cooley, C-O-O-L-E-Y, of abusive sexual conduct, a military court decided April 23, a first for an Air Force general. Commuted the sentences of 75 people convicted of nonviolent drug offenses April 26 by President Joe Biden, who pardoned three others. Arrested a Florida bride, 42, and her caterer, April 18, accused of serving marijuana-laced food to wedding reception guests, February 19. THC was detected in the food, including lasagna. Passed a bill to ask Togo's government to seek to formally join the Commonwealth, a group of mostly former British colonies, by the nation's parliament, April 22. Sentenced former leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, to 5 years in jail by the country's military junta for alleged corruption. She denies the charges, and rights groups condemned the trials. Halted Texas execution, a stay for Melissa Lucio, that's L-U-C-I-O. This short column is written by Sonia Mansour. The highest criminal court in Texas, April 25, halted the execution of Melissa Lucio, a mother whose murder conviction and the death of her two-year-old daughter has come under increasing scrutiny amid doubts about her guilt. Lucio, 53, was sentenced to be executed by lethal injection April 27 for the 2007 death of her daughter, Mariah. But after the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted a stay of execution, her case now heads to a lower court for a hearing on her innocence. Lucio's case has drawn outrage from a bipartisan group of more than 100 Texas state lawmakers, as well as anti-domestic violence, religious, and Latino groups. They argue medical evidence showing that Mariah's death was consistent with an accident, as well as a five-hour-long aggressive interrogation of a woman with a history of being abused, should be reason enough to halt her execution. It is just so clearly a case of coercive interrogation tactics, says Tivon Shardell, one of Lucio's attorneys, who's argued that Lucio asserted her innocence more than 100 times. Died Orrin Hatch, an unexpected dealmaker. That first name is spelled O-R-R-I-N, last name H-A-T-C-H. Orrin Hatch ran for office and won on his first try. as a check on the liberalism he saw seeping from Washington in the 1970s, specifically the deeply conservative Republican loathed from afar the liberal agenda of Senator Edward M. Kennedy. Over time, though, Hatch and Kennedy partnered, as only polar opposites can, to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act, to fund care for patients with HIV/AIDS, and to give states pots of money for children's health care programs that lifted millions of families out of deep poverty, Hatch knew in his early years. The longest-serving Republican in Senate history died April 23 in Salt Lake City. Of his 88 years, 42 were in the Senate. Unflinching in his opposition to abortion rights, same-sex marriage, and union protections, Hatch nevertheless could huddle with unlikely allies to push legislation to the seven presidents who cycled through Washington on his watch. While Hatch introduced constitutional amendments to outlaw abortion and to balance the budget, he also worked with Democratic Representative Henry Waxman to speed up generic drug approvals and Senator Dianne Feinstein to expand federal funding for stem cell research. Because no one questioned his ideology or found him to be a showman, Hatch's colleagues recognized him as an honest negotiator. He considered seeking an eighth term in 2018, but Hatch listened to his constituents who respectfully signaled it was time to move on. By the end, Hatch's record was unmatched in the modern era. He had voted to confirm 10 Supreme Court justices, written more than 750 laws into reality, and subtly steered the country rightward while still finding merit in a compromise grounded in trust. And that article was written by Philip Elliott. This is a question and answer article written by Janelle Ross, The Case for a Fundamentally Different Child Welfare System. Scholar Dorothy Roberts has a record of writing about social problems in ways that researchers and lay people alike recognize as real. Her new book, Torn Apart, applies her lens to the American child protection system, which, as Roberts explains in this conversation with Time, consistently fails to live up to its name. What brought you to this topic is the first question. Answer, I learned about the child welfare system intimately when I was working on my book, Killing the Black Body. I was doing research on prosecutions of black women for being pregnant and using drugs. I discovered black children were grossly overrepresented in the child welfare system. Question, at every level of action these agencies take, there are racial disparities? Answer, one of the most striking findings in a recent study is that more than half of all black children will experience a child welfare investigation by the time they reach 18, 53%. But black children are also more likely than white children to be taken from their families and put in foster care. They are more likely not to go to college after experiencing foster care, more likely to go to prison. So the outcomes are bad, too. Question, why are these disparities so pervasive? Answer, the system's designed to deal with the hardships of children who are disadvantaged by structural inequality, including structural racism, by accusing their parents. Some people will say, well, black children are more likely to have all these interventions because they have greater needs. But first of all, why do they have greater needs? And secondly, why is the response to their greater need this very violent, traumatic approach of family separation? Question, it seems like you're talking about the infrastructure that theoretically protects children as more like a policing force that punishes need. Answer, in a way it is to punish parents who do not conform to certain norms. Look at Texas. Governor Greg Abbott's directive to caseworkers to investigate the families of children who were provided with gender-affirming care. That is a very clear case. Question, what are we to make of the way that directive has galvanized such a strong response? Answer, we should object to Governor Abbott's directive, but the same kinds of incursions on black families have been happening at a higher rate for decades, and it has never gotten that level of public outcry. Question, so what needs to be done here? There are vulnerable children of all races who actually are in danger. Answer, in a nation that truly provided income support, health care, affordable housing, equal high-quality education for all, the vast majority of children in foster care today would not be there. There still would be, of course, children who are profoundly neglected or physically or sexually abused. But the system we have now does not prevent that from happening. We need a fundamentally different way that gets to the root of why there is so much violence in our society. Turning now to the cover story, which is called A Special Report, Inside Zelensky's World, that's Zelensky. As casualties mount and the war nears a critical moment, 2 weeks in the presidential compound show how the Ukrainian leader has changed. This is by Simon Schuster, Kyiv. The photograph is by Alexander Chekmenev for Time. And another photograph does accompany this article. It's a full page, black and white, face and head only of Vladimir Zelensky. This time he's looking at the camera. His eyes are slightly uplifted. It's the same short black hair and short dark facial hair. He's neither smiling nor frowning. He's looking dead ahead. This rather lengthy article may be abridged. The nights are the hardest when he lies there on his cot, the whine of the air raid sirens in his ears, his phone still buzzing beside him. Its screen makes his face look like a ghost in the dark, his eyes scanning messages he did not have a chance to read during the day. Some from his wife and kids, many from his advisors, a few from his troops, surrounded in their bunkers, asking him again and again for more weapons to break the Russian siege. Inside his own bunker, the president has a habit of staring at his daily agenda even when the day's over. He lies awake and wonders whether he missed something, forgot someone. It is pointless, Vladimir Zelensky told me at the presidential compound in Kyiv, just outside the office where he sometimes sleeps. It's the same agenda. I see it's over for today, but I look at it several times and sense something's wrong. It is not anxiety that keeps his eyes from closing. It is my conscience bothering me. The same thought keeps turning over in his head. I've let myself sleep. Now what? Something's happening right now. Somewhere in Ukraine, the bombs are still falling. Civilians are still trapped in basements or under rubble. The Russians are still committing crimes of war, rape, torture. Their bombs are leveling entire towns. The city of Mariupol and its last defenders are besieged. A critical battle has started in the east. Amid all this, Zelensky, the comedian-turned-president, still needs to keep the world engaged and to convince foreign leaders his country needs their help right now, at any cost. Outside Ukraine, Zelensky told me, people see this war on Instagram, on social media. When they get sick of it, they'll scroll away. It's human nature. Horrors have a way of making us close our eyes. It's a lot of blood, he explains. It's a lot of emotion. Zelensky senses the world's attention flagging, and it troubles him nearly as much as Russian bombs. Most nights when he scans his agenda, his list of tasks has less to do with war itself than the way it's perceived. His mission is to make the free world experience this war the way Ukraine does, as a matter of its own survival. He seems to be pulling it off. The U.S. and Europe has rushed to his aid, providing more weapons to Ukraine than they've given any other country since World War II. Thousands of journalists have come to Kyiv, filling inboxes of his staff with interview requests. My request was not just for a chance to question the president. It was to see the war the way he and his team have experienced it. Over 2 weeks in April, they allowed me to do that in the presidential compound on Bonkova Street, to observe their routines and hang around the offices where they now live and work. Zelensky and his staff made the place feel almost normal. We cracked jokes, drank coffee, waited for meetings to start or end. Only the soldiers, our ever-present chaperones, embodied the war as they took us around, shining flashlights down dark corridors past the rooms where they slept on the floor. The experience illustrated how much Zelensky has changed since we first met 3 years ago, backstage at his comedy show in Kyiv, when he was still an actor running for president. His sense of humor is still intact. It's a means of survival, he says, but 2 months of war have made him harder, quicker to anger, a lot more comfortable with risk. Russian troops came within minutes of finding him and his family in the first hours of the war, their gunfire once audible inside his office walls. Images of dead civilians haunt him. So do the daily appeals from his troops, hundreds of whom are trapped below ground, running out of food, water, and ammunition. This account of Zelensky at war is based on interviews with him and nearly a dozen of his aides. Most of them were thrown into this experience with no real preparation. Many of them, like Zelensky himself, come from the worlds of acting and show business. Others were known in Ukraine as bloggers and journalists before the war. On the day we last met, the 55th of the invasion, Zelensky announced the start of a battle that could end the war. Russian forces had regrouped after sustaining heavy losses around Kyiv, and they had begun a fresh assault in the east. There, Zelensky says, the armies of one side or the other will likely be destroyed. This will be a full-scale battle, bigger than any we've seen on the territory of Ukraine, Zelensky told me April 19. If we hold out, he says, it will be a decisive moment for us, the tipping point. In the first weeks of the invasion, when the Russian artillery was within striking distance of Kyiv, Zelensky seldom waited for sunrise before calling his top general for a status report. The first call usually took place around 5 a.m., before the light began peeking through the sandbags in the windows of the compound. Later, they moved the conversation back by a couple hours, enough time for Zelensky to have breakfast, invariably eggs, and to make his way to the presidential chambers. This set of rooms changed little after the invasion. It remained a cocoon of gold leaf and palatial furniture that Zelensky's staff find oppressive. At least if the place gets bombed, one of them joked, we won't have to look at this stuff anymore. But the streets around the compound became a maze of checkpoints and barricades. Civilian cars cannot get close, and soldiers ask pedestrians for secret passwords that change daily, often nonsense phrases like coffee cup suitor that would be hard for a Russian to pronounce. Beyond the checkpoints is the government district known as the Triangle, which Russian forces tried to seize at the start of the invasion. When those first hours came up in our interview, Zelensky warned me the memories exist in a fragmented way, a disjointed set of images and sounds. Among the most vivid took place before sunrise, February 24, when he and his wife Olena Zelenska went to tell their children bombing had started and to prepare them to flee their home. Their daughter is 17 and their son is 9. Both old enough to understand they were in danger. We woke them up, Zelensky told me, his eyes turning inward. It was loud. There were explosions over there. It soon became clear the presidential offices were not the safest place to be. The military informed Zelensky Russian strike teams had parachuted into Kyiv to kill or capture him and his family. Before that night, we had only ever seen such things in the movies, says Andriy Yermak, the president's chief of staff. Pausing here in the text to read the caption of another photograph, Zelensky is with his chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, Y-E-R-M-A-K, and he speaks to journalists in Bucha, April 4. He is actually surrounded by many more people, all of them in khaki and black and camouflage, and some of them obviously soldiers wearing helmets. Zelensky himself is in the front of the group wearing what looks like a dark gray khaki coat, because this was in April in Ukraine. Again, his dark hair cropped short, his facial hair cropped short. In this photo, which is in color, it looks like his eyes are deep brown, and he's speaking to at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 microphones. One says 2DF, one says AA. None of them appears to have the initials with which we're familiar with our network TV stations. Returning now to the text. As Ukrainians' troops fought the Russians back in the streets, the presidential guard tried to seal the compound with whatever they could find. A gate at the rear entrance was blocked with a pile of police barricades and plywood boards, resembling a mound of junkyard scrap more than fortification. Friends and allies rushed to Zelensky's side, sometimes in violation of security protocols. Several brought their families to the compound. If the president were to be killed, the chain of succession in Ukraine calls for Speaker of Parliament to take command. But Ruslan Stefanchuk, who holds that post, drove straight to Bonkova Street on the morning of the invasion rather than taking shelter at a distance. Stefanchuk was among the first to see the president in his office that day. It was not fear on his face, he told me. It was a question. How could this be? For months, Zelensky had downplayed warnings from Washington that Russia was about to invade. Now he registered the fact that an all-out war had broken out, but could not yet grasp the totality of what it meant. Maybe these words sound vague or pompous, says Stefanchuk, but we sense the order of the world collapsing. Soon the speaker rushed down the street to the parliament and presided over a vote to impose martial law across the country. Zelensky signed the decree that afternoon. As night fell the first evening, gunfights broke out around the government quarter. Guards inside the compound shut the lights and brought bulletproof vests and assault rifles for Zelensky and about a dozen of his aides. Only a few of them knew how to handle the weapons. One was Oleksiy Aristovich, a veteran of Ukraine's military intelligence service. It was an absolute madhouse, he told me, automatics for everyone. Russian troops, he says, made two attempts to storm the compound. Zelensky later told me that his wife and children were still there at the time. Offers came in from American and British forces to evacuate the president and his team. The idea was to help them set up a government in exile, most likely in eastern Poland, that could continue to lead from afar. None of Zelensky's advisors recall him giving these offers any serious consideration. Speaking on a secure landline with the Americans, he responded with a zinger that made headlines around the world. I need ammunition, not a ride. We thought that was brave, says a U.S. official briefed on the call, but very risky. Zelensky's bodyguards felt the same. They also urged him to leave the compound right away. Its buildings are nestled in a densely populated neighborhood, surrounded by private homes that could serve as nests for enemy snipers. Some houses are close enough to throw a grenade through the window from across the street. The place was wide open, says Arestovich. We did not even have concrete blocks to close the street. Somewhere outside the capital, a secure bunker was waiting for the president, equipped to withstand a lengthy siege. Zelensky refused to go there. Instead, on the second night of the invasion, while Ukrainian forces were fighting Russians in nearby streets, the president decided to walk outside into the courtyard and film a video message on his phone. "We are all here," Zelensky said after doing a roll call of the officials by his side. They were dressed in the army green T-shirts and jackets that would become their wartime uniforms, defending our independence, our country. By then, Zelensky understood his role in this war. The eyes of his people and much of the world were fixed on him. "You understand they're watching," he says. "You're a symbol. You need to act the way the head of state must act." When he posted the 40-second clip to Instagram February 25, the sense of unity it projected was a bit misleading. Zelensky had been alarmed by the number of officials and even military officers who had fled. He did not respond with threats or ultimatums. If they needed time to evacuate their families, he allowed it. Then he asked them to come back to their posts. Most of them did. Other people volunteered to live in the bunkers of the presidential compound. Serhiy Lyshenko, a prominent journalist and lawmaker, arrived a few days after the invasion to help the team counter Russian disinformation. He had to sign a non-disclosure agreement forbidding him from sharing any details about the bunker's design, location, or amenities. All of its inhabitants are bound by this pledge of secrecy. They are not even allowed to talk about the food they eat down there. Its isolation often forced Zelensky's team to experience the war through their screens, somewhat like the rest of us. Footage of battles and rocket attacks tended to appear on social media before the military could brief Zelensky on these events. It was typical for the president and his staff to gather around a phone or laptop in the bunker, cursing images of devastation or cheering a drone strike on a Russian tank. "This was a favorite," Lyshenko told me, pulling up a clip of a Russian helicopter getting blown out of the sky. Memes and viral videos were a frequent source of levity, as were the war ballads Ukrainians wrote, recorded, and posted online. One of them went like this: "Look how our people, look how all Ukraine united the world against the Russians. Soon all the Russians, they'll be gone, and we'll have peace in all the world." It was not long before Zelensky insisted on going to see the action for himself. In early March, when the Russians were still shelling Kyiv and trying to encircle the capital, the president drove out of his compound in secret, accompanied by two of his friends and a small team of bodyguards. "We made the decision to go on the fly," says Yermak, the chief of staff. "There were no cameras with them." Some of Zelensky's closest aides only learned about the trip nearly 2 months later when he brought it up during our interview. Heading north from Bonkova Street, the group went to a collapsed bridge that marked the front line at the edge of the city. It was the first time Zelensky had seen the effects of the fighting up close. He marveled at the size of a crater left by an explosion in the road. When they stopped to talk to Ukrainian troops at a checkpoint, Zelensky's bodyguards, he says, were losing their minds. The president had no pressing reason to be that close to the Russian positions. He says he just wanted to have a look and to talk to the people at the front lines. I'm pausing again for another photo. This one is in color. It's at least three quarters of a page in size. The caption reads, "In the village of Mala Rohan, mourners attend the funeral of Artur Shukin, who died March 25. Okay, there's a big hole in the ground right in front of me. That's in the very closest foreground, a hole for a coffin. The ground is brownish in color, not dark black fertile brown, but brown, and not red clay ground, just brown. There's a floral casket drape hanging nearby on kind of a makeshift cross. I wonder if it's to be laid upon a casket when it arrives for burial. In the background, two people are embracing, a man and a woman. They're both dressed casually, but for cold weather, dark pants and boots or trackers, tennis shoes, black jackets. That's all I can see. They're embracing one another. And behind them, rows and rows and rows of tattered, flying Ukrainian flags, the bicolor, the blue on top, the yellow on the bottom. Behind that, an icy, bluish-white sky. But in the mid-foreground, I'd say a dozen or so, granite tombstones, fairly high, as tall as the people embracing in front of them. I don't know if they're military issue and if that's why there's a flag flying at each of them, but they're asymmetrical. They're fairly tall and probably not too thick based upon what I can see in the three-dimensional aspects of this photograph. And then beyond them, there are no more flags flying, just rows and rows and rows and rows of black and gray tombstones. And behind them, a winter field in white. And beyond that, just in front of this icy blue cold winter sky, are bare trees. And back to the text. A few days later, Zelensky went on a ride that aides refer to as the Borscht trip. At a checkpoint near the edge of the city, the president met a man who would bring a fresh pot of borscht for the troops every day. They stood there, within range of enemy snipers and artillery, and had a bowl of soup with bread, talking about the Soviet Union and what the Russians had become since its collapse. "He told me how much he hated the Russians," Zelensky recalls. "Then the cook went to the trunk of his car and pulled out some medals he had earned while serving in the Soviet military." The conversation left a deep impression on Zelensky. "It felt right," says Yermak, "just talking to the people we work for." Such outings were rare, though he received frequent updates from his generals and gave them broad instructions. Zelensky did not pretend to be a tactical savant. His defense minister was seldom by his side, nor were any of Ukraine's top military commanders. "He lets them do the fighting," says Aristovich, his advisor on military affairs. His days were a succession of statements, meetings, interviews, usually conducted through the screen of a laptop or phone. Courtesy calls took up time, like one Zoom session with the actors Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher, who'd raised money for Ukraine through a GoFundMe campaign. Ahead of his nightly address to the nation, Zelensky would set out themes in conversation with his staff. "Very often people ask, who is Zelensky's speechwriter?" says Dasha Zarivna, a communications advisor. "The main one is him," she says. "He works on every line." Through March and early April, Zelensky averaged about one speech per day, addressing venues as diverse as the Parliament of South Korea, the World Bank, the Grammy Awards. Each one was crafted with his audience in mind. When he spoke to the U.S. Congress, he referenced Pearl Harbor and 9/11. The German Parliament heard him invoke the history of the Holocaust and the Berlin Wall. The constant rush of urgent tasks and small emergencies had a numbing effect on the team, distending the passage of time in ways one advisor describes as hallucinogenic. Days would feel like hours and hours like days. The fear became acute only in the moments before sleep. "That's when reality catches up with you," says Lashenko. "That's when you lay there and think about the bombs." In early April, the team began emerging much more often from the bunker. The Ukrainian forces had driven the enemy back from the suburbs of Kyiv, and the Russians were moving their forces to the battle for the east. On the 40th day of the invasion, Zelensky made another trip outside the compound. this time with cameras in tow. He rode that morning in a convoy of armored vehicles to Bukha, a well-to-do commuter town where Russian troops had slaughtered hundreds of civilians. Their bodies were left scattered around town, Zelensky said, found in barrels, basements, strangled, tortured. Nearly all had fatal gunshot wounds. Some had been lying in the streets for days. As Zelensky and his team saw the atrocities up close, their horror quickly turned to rage. We wanted to call off all peace talks, says David Arakamiya, whom Zelensky had chosen to lead negotiations with the Russians. I could barely even look them in the face. April 8. While investigators were still exhuming mass graves in Bukha, Russian missiles struck a train station in Kramatorsk in eastern Ukraine. Thousands of women, children, and elderly people had gathered with their luggage and their pets, hoping to catch evacuation trains. The missiles killed at least 50 and injured more than 100 others. Several children lost limbs. Zelensky learned about the attack through a series of photos taken at the scene and forwarded to him that morning. One lingers in his mind. It showed a woman who'd been beheaded by the explosion. She was wearing these bright, memorable clothes, he says. He could not shake the image that afternoon when he walked into one of the most important meetings of his career. Ursula von der Leyen, top official in the EU, had traveled to Kiev by train to offer Ukraine a fast track to membership. The country had been waiting for the opportunity for decades. But when the moment finally came, the president could not stop thinking about the headless woman on the ground. Zelensky now works most often in the compound situation room, which is neither below ground nor fortified. It's a windowless boardroom with one embellishment, a trident, the state symbol of Ukraine, glowing on the wall behind Zelensky's chair. Large screens run along the other walls, and a camera faces the president from the center of the conference table. At around 9 a.m., April 19, the faces of his generals and intelligence chiefs filled the screens in front of Zelensky. Overnight, the president had given a video address to the nation, announcing the start of the battle for eastern Ukraine. Now he wanted to hear where the fighting was most intense, where his troops had retreated, who had deserted, what help they needed, where they had managed to advance. At certain points in the east, it's just insane, he told me later that day, summarizing the general's briefing. Really horrible in terms of the frequency of the strikes, the heavy artillery fire, and the losses. For over a month, Zelensky had been texting with two Ukrainian commanders. They were the last defenders of Mariupol, a city of 500,000 people the Russians encircled at the start of the invasion. A small force is still holding out inside an enormous steel factory. One of their leaders, Major Serhiy Volinsky of the 36th Separate Marine Brigade, had been in touch with Zelensky for weeks. We know each other well by now, Zelensky told me. Most days they call or text each other, sometimes in the middle of the night. Early on, the soldier sent the president a selfie they had taken together long before the invasion. We're even embracing there like friends, he says. Perhaps it was lucky for me to meet the president toward the end of a very long day. Nearly 2 months into the invasion, he had changed. There were new creases in his face, and he had no longer searched the room for his advisors when considering an answer to a question. I have gotten older, he admitted. I've aged from all this wisdom I never wanted. It's the wisdom tied to the number of people who've died and the torture the Russian soldiers perpetrated. That kind of wisdom, he added, trailing off. To be honest, I never had the goal of attaining knowledge like that. It made me wonder whether he regretted the choice he made 3 years ago, around the time we first met. His comedy show had been a hit. Standing in his dressing room, he was still glowing from the admiration of the crowd. Friends waited backstage to start the after party. Fans gathered outside to take a picture of him. This was just 3 months into his run for the presidency, when it was not too late for Zelensky to turn back. But he does not regret the choice he made, not even with the hindsight of war. "Not for a second," he told me in the presidential compound. He does not know how the war will end or how history will describe his place in it. In this moment, he only knows Ukraine needs a wartime president, and that is the role he intends to play. That lengthy article, only slightly abridged, was written by Simon Schuster, Kiev, with reporting by Nick Popley, Washington, and Simone Shaw, New York. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Here's the thing about absolute denials. You can make them, but only once. So when House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy released a statement April 21 denying reporting that he confidentially told Republican colleagues in the wake of the January 6 attempted insurrection that he planned to tell then-President Donald Trump to resign, Washington took notice. McCarthy called the book excerpt from his New York Times reporters totally false and wrong. It was a double dog dare, if ever there were one, in political journalism, right up there with Gary Hart's challenging reporters to prove his affair that ultimately ended his 1988 presidential bid. 9 hours after McCarthy lashed out, the journalists Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns were on Rachel Maddow's MSNBC show, and they had the receipts, in this case, the audio recording, from McCarthy's close-circle call with just three of his top lieutenants. The call, quite literally, was coming from inside the House. That's with a capital H. It is merely the latest example of why assumptions about McCarthy's rise to Speaker in a Republican-led House may prove ill-founded. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.